The period of time in between when Yaakov is running from his parents' home and when he finally gets to Lavan's house is obviously a very formative experience. Vayetze Yaakov Be'er Sheva, this is for those who do Parsha Candy, if you have younger siblings or something, my favorite Parsha Candy of all time is Vayetze Yaakov Be'er Sheva to buy 7 gummy bears. Be'er Sheva, get it? Okay. So anyway, so Yaakov, that period of time in between, Rabbi Yechiel Levman, who makes the Parsha Candy, texted me this week, don't forget your 7 gummy bears. Okay, so because he knows it's my favorite. So between when Yaakov has to run away from his parents' house and when he finally arrives at Lavan's house, obviously a very formative experience in Yaakov's life. There are hundreds, if not thousands of questions you could ask about every move that Yaakov made, you know, especially once you get into the Midrashim, you know, he goes to sleep and the Midrash says that when he takes the Evan and it turns into 12 stones, or he takes the, right, so the 12 that turn into 1, that he's making a deal with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a whole, you know, the lots and lots of questions you could ask about what exactly was going through his mind and what he gained from each experience. But let's just ask 3, because that's what we do. First of all, Yaakov was pretty old at the time. He gets to Yeshiva Shem Ve'ever. And the idea of a guy learning before getting married, we support that. You know, we like that. We like the idea that you should learn a little bit, you should spend some time in the Dal Kosle Beis HaMedrash before you get married. And, you know, the Gemara in Kiddushin discusses it in great detail of exactly when it's appropriate to learn before you get married, when it's not. Wonderful. But there's a limit, right? Everybody agrees that, you know, there's a certain point in time where you should say, okay, I've been learning full time, now it's time to go look for a shidduch. Yaakov had spent decades learning from very, very great rebbeim, from his father, from his grandfather. What did Shem Ve'ever have to offer that Yaakov didn't already have in all of the Torah that he was learning from his father and his grandfather? That's true. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a famous Mahalich, Ayin Sham and Emes Yaakov. If you want to see Rabbi Yaakov's Mahalich, we're not going to go through that Mahalich right now. Second question. After the 14 years, Yaakov is on a Madrega we can't even imagine. He didn't sleep for 14 years. We don't even know what that means. We have difficulty keeping our eyes open for 14 hours straight. You know, in the middle of the day, our eyes are, you know, closing. Teenage boys have a difficulty keeping their eyes open 14 minutes straight, especially put them in a classroom and put a teacher in front of them. Forget about it. 14 years of learning. And he didn't close his eyes, he didn't go to sleep. We don't know how that's possible. It's true that in our generation, we've had, or at least in the previous generation, tzaddikim, who may have slept but never really went to sleep. Rav Ruderman used to tell the story about how he used to stay by a gevir in Miami Beach. It used to be that there was someone in Miami Beach who used to host the big gedolim when they would come. I guess big gedolim is redundant, but the gedolim when they would come to vacation in Miami. So when Rav Ruderman came to the house of this gevir, the housekeeper asked, "Would you like a bed in your room?" And Rav Ruderman was like, yeah. That's a strange question to ask a guest. Would you like a bed in your room? She said, oh, no. It was just because the last guy didn't want a bed in his room. Who is the last guy? The Satmar Rebbe. You know, say what you want about his hashkafos, but remember, we're speaking about Nish Kadosh. The Satmar Rebbe didn't sleep in a bed. He gave him a chair and he learned till he fell asleep in the chair. He didn't sleep in a bed. So in this state of elevated Kedusha that we can't even fathom, Yaakov institutes a tefillah. You don't want to compare the tefillahs of the Avos to each other, but from our perspective it would seem that Yaakov was formulating this tefillah at a very, very high madrega, at a real high point in his life, the Bechir Sheba Avos, probably at his highest spiritual peak, formulating this tefillah in the holiest place after having gone through a transcendent experience, right? And what was that tefillah? Arvis. Tefillah's Arvis. And what do we know distinguishes Arvis from the other tefillahs? Gemara says, tefillah's Arvis, Rishos. That's the best he could do. You know, Yitzchak and Avram gave us tefillos that are a chova. And it doesn't seem that those tefillos were quite with the level of spirituality that Yaakov was on at this time. The best he could do is tefillos arvus for shus at this time. A third question, and this one I heard from Sender Gross last year. Right? Last year you attended Rabbi Pelkowitz's celebration of 65 years of being in Rabbanus. Right? Remember that? I remember when they celebrated Rabbi Pelkowitz's 50 years of being in Rabbanus. I was just starting out as the assistant rabbi in Shari Tfila, and they were celebrating his 50 years of being in Rabbanus. So what did I tell you last year when you told me they're celebrating 65 years? I'm pretty sure he's going to outlast me. I can tell you 15 years later, I'm pretty sure Rabbi Pelkowitz is going to outlast me. But anyway, so Rabbi Pelkowitz, in that event, according to Sender, posed a very interesting question about Yaakov's dream of the Malachim. There are plenty of interpretations of why the angels were going up and down and what they symbolized, and it's wonderful. You have to read all the Mefarshim, you find great things. But there's a certain oddity that doesn't really get a lot of attention. If you think of angels, how do angels move? Ladders? Like if an angel wants to ascend, how would you imagine an angel ascends? He floats, he flies, he's got wings, he's got, you know, climbing on a ladder? Is he using his arms or his wings, right? Like what is it? Climbing a ladder? It's like a mixed metaphor almost, right? Angels climbing a ladder, it's so strange. I would imagine maybe Elio's chariots of fire or something like that. A ladder is so mundane and so primitive and difficult. It's hard to climb a ladder. Why would the Malachim be climbing a ladder? So perhaps the Yesod is as follows. The mission that Yaakov was sent on by his parents was to find a wife. It would stand to reason that everything he did and everything he experienced in some way relates to the mission that he was sent on. He's supposed to go get married. Yaakov, of course, didn't just find a wife. He was a very advanced student, right? He found two wives. And both of them became Imos B'Yisrael. If you appreciate each of those relationships, the Leah relationship and the Rachel relationship, maybe we'll be able to better understand the preparation that went into achieving those relationships. May shed light for us also on, you know, for people my age, what we can do to enhance our own family life, and for people your age to think forward about the kinds of things you look for in enhancing family life in the future. When people describe Yaakov's search for a wife, usually the emphasis is on Rachel. You know, glowing, romantic, he fell in love with her, she's the one he wanted, love at first sight, she was destined to be with him. Yeah, this is the stuff of Hollywood. Work 7 years, and don't worry, those 7 years were kiyamim achadim. It felt like nothing because it was so worth it. When people describe the relationship with Leah, it usually is described in the exact opposite way. She wasn't meant for him. He was fooled into marrying her. Vayar Hashem ki sinua Leah. Okay, so you'll translate it nicely when you're speaking in public, right? What do the words mean? Ki sinua Leah. Leah was hated. No love, no excitement, resentment of having been stuck with her. There's probably no better way to express the Leah relationship than looking at the very first conversation that we ever know of. The first conversation that we ever know of that Yaakov had with Leah. For all the years he was living in her father's home, we don't know of a single conversation with her. And there might have been conversations with Yaakov, like pass the salt, I don't know, they ate at the same table, right? There might have been conversations, we don't know of any of them. It's only when he's already married to her, and Yaakov discovers who he's married to, they finally have a conversation, and it could not have gone any worse. The Medrash tells us, Bitsafra Umrala, in the morning, right? Not, good morning, honey, how are you? Breakfast in bed? No. What does he say? Rama'a bas Rama'i. You awful, deceitful person, you're just like your dad. By the way, if your wife ever does something that you don't like, it's not right to A, call her names, and B, say, and you're just like your mother. Rama'a bas Rama'i. That's what he goes with. Amrale, she says, V'is sofer delesle Talmud? You think that there's a student who doesn't have a teacher? Lokein avicha tzavach lach, Esav va'at anile. Didn't your father say, hey, Esav, and you said, yeah, it's me. Where do you think I learned a lie from? You're a great liar. It's brutal. That's the first married conversation that they have. But then you think about it a little bit further, and you realize that Yaakov's marriage with Leah was extremely successful, extremely fruitful. It produced half of the Shifteka. Would have produced more had Leah not had the sensitivity to daven that Dina should change into a girl, or the way the Marsha understands, to do a fetal swap. Right? Targum Yonasan and the Marsha both understand that that Rachel was already pregnant and Leah was pregnant, and she davened for the babies to swap. Okay, it's a good maramakob in halacha. Rabbi Mati Neuberger pointed out to me this morning, because if you hold like the Targum Yonasan and the Marsha, so that's a maramakom for some of the modern shaylas we have, where if it's an egg from one woman and then another woman is, you know, carries the baby, right? What do they call that? A surrogate mother, who's the real mother. Whereas if you learn like the Pasha Pshat, like Rashi, like the Gemara, then it's not a maramakom at all for that topic. Okay, but whatever it is. But Leah produced six Shiftei Ka and could have produced even more. She's the one who Yaakov was ultimately buried with. Rachel is in Kever Rachel. A high school rabbi told me that, one of his talmidim said, who's buried in Kever Rachel? Good cash. In the Sheva Brachos, we talk about a relationship of Ahava and Achva. And maybe it's not so crazy to suggest that the relationships with Rachel and Leah are two models of Ahava and Achva, respectively. Rachel, pure Ahava, an overwhelming feeling of love. Ahava is the excitement of choosing the person to love. Leah represents Achva. Brotherhood is not something you choose. You don't get to choose who your siblings are. It's something you're stuck with. You're born, your siblings are your siblings, and that's it. You didn't choose who your brother is. But the amazing thing about brothers is that even though you don't choose who your brother is, he often becomes the person that you're closest with. You know, I didn't choose my brother. I only have one brother. I didn't choose my brother. I couldn't have chosen better, though. You know? And there are a lot of people that feel that way. That you become so close with a brother. You have no choice but to figure out, you know, okay, we're stuck together. If you were me, we're sharing a room, you know? Here we are, sharing a room. Yeah, I grew up in Lawrence. We still shared a room, okay? So it's not such a pebble. Okay, fine. So we shared a room. And you figure it out. You make it work. And you learn to love the person. You have no choice but to figure it out. The relationship between Yaakov and Leah is inspiring in the sense that it was a learned love. It was a love that was worked on. It wasn't a love that just automatically came naturally. And our job in our relationships is to learn how to fuse the two. We hope for a single relationship that has both Ahava and Achva. Hollywood teaches us all about Ahava. Not even Ahava. It teaches us all about lust. But let's say Ahava. Ahava, when left alone, lasts about as long as a Hollywood marriage lasts. Not very long. Modern society doesn't do nearly enough to promote the notion of achva, of working through good and bad together, growing together, working on a relationship, developing a relationship, understanding the other person, understanding what upsets them, what makes them happy, what you could do for them. We don't focus on that in modern society. And maybe when you keep that in mind, and I'm not trying to put the Leah relationship into a box, or the Rachel relationship into a box. I'm saying, obviously, they both had a certain level of Ahava and a certain level of Achva. Try and use these as models, as examples. When you put that in mind, when you keep that in mind, you can understand all the different experiences that were highlighted about Yaakov's time between his parents' home and Lavan's home. First, he had to turn to Shem Ve'Ever, where the level of Torah couldn't have been the same level as it was by Yitzchak Avinu. But it was a place where people from all walks of life could come. It was not a very insular yeshiva. Yaakov spent 14 years learning about people, hearing different people's struggles. After all the years that he had to spend focused on being sure enough of himself to avoid Esav's influence and to build up himself, he now had to spend some time learning about other people, learning about how to see things from someone else's perspective. And in that regard, the first conversation with Leah was so impactful. Yaakov accuses Leah from his own perspective, and she responds, "You understand why you responded to the name Esav. That you don't have kashas on. You understand that because you're looking at it from your perspective. Why don't you try to look at my predicament from my perspective, and maybe you'll have a similar understanding?" We naturally could defend our own behaviors. But when someone else has a very, very similar behavior, if we're looking at things selfishly, we can't defend it. But when we appreciate from their perspective, we'll be just as easily able to defend their perspective as we are ours. "When you see things from my perspective," Leah tells Yaakov, "yeah, you'll be ready for a marriage." Yaakov's tefillah was offered with great kedusha. But unlike other tefillahs, which are mandatory and therefore create a certain type of achva relationship with Hashem, Yaakov's tefillah is a rishus to perfectly complement the other tefillahs. It's not enough to have an achva relationship with Hashem. There has to also be an ahava relationship with Hashem. It's not enough to have the obligations. We have to have the excitement of Yiddishkeit. We have to have the joy of Yiddishkeit. The idea that we're going to be able, that serving Hashem, that learning His Torah is going to be exciting for us, that being able to connect with Him through a powerful and meaningful tefillah is going to be exciting to us. There has to be a certain sense of ahava. And the Rachel relationship is symbolized by the Malachim floating on clouds toward each other. But life isn't about floating on clouds forever. There are steps, there are madregos. They're difficult to climb sometimes. There are ups, there are downs, there are olim and there are yordim. So yeah, you're going to have malachim, but those malachim have to be built and constantly nurtured. And maybe that's the mixed metaphor of the Pelkovitz Ha'ara. Why are these malachim climbing on the ladders? They're climbing on the ladders to highlight that's how relationships are made. And it's not only true of marriage relationships, but it's most important, I would say, when it comes to marriage relationships and when it comes to our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. But it's true of every relationship. That, you know, there are some people you just get along with, you just like. You know, the first time you meet them, they have like a certain chayin, they have like, you just get them, they get you, you know, just you hit it off right away. And then there are other people that just like, I don't know, they seem standoffish, or you just like can't connect, they don't get your jokes, you don't get their jokes, like it just doesn't click, it doesn't work. So what, so you could just like ignore them and hate them? No, sometimes you can develop very meaningful relationships with people like that. It takes some work, and it's often worth the work to develop really, really important relationships with people like that. Again, ideally, in an ideal marriage, there is this powerful ahava, but then that powerful ahava is nurtured through many, many years of increased achva, where you find that when you nurture it and you build it and you work on it through achva, you find that there are other bursts of inspiration of ahava throughout all the years. I guess I'm in anniversary mode. Yesterday was my anniversary, so I'm in anniversary mode. But that's a machshava about Yaakov and Rachel and Leah.